Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUSCast, incorporation in the Eighth Amendment's Excessive Fines Clause edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On February 20th, 2019, the Supreme Court decided Timms v. Indiana, a case involving the incorporation of the Eighth Amendment's Excessive Fines Clause against the states. Following his arrest en route to a controlled drug purchase after having previously purchased about $400 worth of heroin from undercover police officers, Tyson Timms pled guilty to felony counts of drug dealing and conspiracy to commit theft and was sentenced to a year of home detention and several years of probation, plus roughly $1,200 in police costs and related fees. In addition, the state of Indiana sought forfeiture of Timms' Land Rover, which he had purchased using $42,000 of his late father's life insurance proceeds. Indiana claimed that it could seize the car because it had been driven to buy and transport heroin, even though the car was worth more than four times the maximum fine permitted for Timms' drug conviction. The Supreme Court of Indiana upheld the forfeiture against an Eighth Amendment challenge on the grounds that the U.S. Supreme Court had never incorporated that amendment's excessive fines clause against the states. The Supreme Court granted certiorari to consider the issue. By a vote of 9-0, the Supreme Court vacated the judgment of the Supreme Court of Indiana and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Ginsburg, the Supreme Court held that the 14th Amendment incorporates the 8th Amendment's excessive fines clause against the states. Justice Ginsburg's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Breyer, Alito, Sotomayor, Kagan, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. Justice Gorsuch filed a concurring opinion. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. And now, to discuss the case, we have Christopher Green, Associate Professor of Law and HLA Hart Scholar in Law and Philosophy at the University of Mississippi School of Law.
The Timms opinion is here, less than 3 months after oral argument, including both the holidays and some major health scares for the opinion's author, Justice Ginsburg. It is good to see the justice back to her quick opinion writing form. The court was unsurprisingly unanimous in applying the Eighth Amendment prohibition on excessive fines to states, and the court also split in an unsurprising way on which clause to use. Justice Ginsburg applied the substantive due process standard for McDonald v. Chicago, the Second Amendment incorporation case from 2010. Incorporation is appropriate if a right is fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty, or deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. An issue here. Is this two ways to be protected, or just one? Justice Alito's opinion in McDonald, following footnote 14 from the Duncan Sixth Amendment jury incorporation case from 1968, suggests that fundamentality consists in deep-rootedness in history and tradition. But Ginsburg's opinion in Timms could be read to make fundamentality and tradition two separate ways to be covered by the 14th Amendment. Recalling the McDonald context may help keep this disjunctive reading at bay. Another big question. Is tradition back as the way to do substantive due process? Tradition seemed like it was out in 1965 when Griswold used the penumbras formed by emanations from the Bill of Rights for the right to contraception, rather than tradition, as the second Justice Harlan's concurrence would have preferred. But tradition seemed to become the touchstone in 1968 in Duncan. But in 1973, Roe constitutionalized abortion rights contrary to a substantial tradition of prohibiting it. But tradition seemed dispositive again in Moore in 1977 on extended families' right to live together, and in Bowers in 1986 on the lack of a right to intimate sexual behavior. But in 1992, Casey reaffirmed Roe and the right to define one's own concept of existence, so tradition seemed out again. But Glucksberg brought tradition back in 1997, rejecting a right to assisted suicide. But it looked like it was gone again in 2003 when Lawrence overruled Bowers. But McDonald in 2010 used tradition yet again, citing Glucksberg. But in 2015, Obergefell said Glucksberg was not the right approach for marriage cases and imposed same-sex marriage despite two-thirds of the states rejecting it. But now in 2019, we're using the tradition test that McDonald took from Glucksberg as though Obergefell had never happened. So I count nine flips since 1965. That's an odd number, so the tradition light is back to on. So Harlan's traditionalism is winning again, for now. Not so Harlan's partial incorporationism, the possibility of different rules for the feds and states. Justice Stevens made a big push for it in McDonald, but Justice Alito and the majority said no. Indiana did likewise in Timms, but was likewise rejected. As Justice Ginsburg puts it, there is no daylight between the meaning expressed by the Eighth Amendment in 1791 and the meaning expressed by the 14th Amendment in 1868, insofar as it bans excessive fines. No one on the court, alas, has picked up the Harlan-Stevens mantle. I think Harlan was right, but the court was having none of it. Once a right is deemed fundamental enough to apply to states, all of the right applies, even if some of those applications seem iffy enough not to be fundamental all on their own. The court relied on two recent close cases involving the incorporated First and Fourth Amendments. The court had, in each case, only looked to the 1791 issue, not whether an interpretation in the circumstances would meet the 14th Amendment test for fundamentality. McDonald and now Timms make clear that when the court looks through the 14th Amendment at an incorporated right in the Bill of Rights, the court sees it just as it was in 1791, with no 1868 filter. The 14th Amendment in this context becomes perfectly transparent, or even invisible. Another issue about tradition, one in which Timms and McDonald differ, is how far tradition extends up in time. McDonald mentioned that 22 of 37 states in 1868 had state constitutional rights to keep and bear arms, but not that 44 of 50 states have them today, even though the 44 of 50 ratio was both much higher and mentioned a lot in the McDonald briefing, even by Justice Scalia at the argument. In Timms, the court mentioned that 35 of 37 states in 1868 had prohibitions on excessive fines, but also that every state has one today. This is perhaps a move in the direction of Justice Breyer, who complained in McDonald that the court did not consider whether the right to keep and bear arms had retained its fundamentality since Reconstruction. This is also a move back to the approach to incorporation of the 1960s, when the court in six of its nine incorporation cases conducted a poll of the law in states today to see if denying a right made a state an outlier to the American tradition of civil liberty. It is interesting that Justice Thomas's opinion in Timms, like Alito's opinion in McDonald, stops his analysis of tradition in 1868. This perhaps suggests that Thomas takes an 1868-focused approach to 14th Amendment rights in general. I segue then to Justice Thomas, who has for 20 years, with virtually all 14th Amendment scholars on his side, advocated moving incorporation of substantive rights in the Bill of Rights from the Due Process Clause to the Privileges or Immunities Clause. In Timms, Justice Thomas has a buddy again, as he did in 1999 when Chief Justice Rehnquist joined his dissent in Sains v. Roe. He had no buddy, alas, in 2010 in McDonald. But now Justice Gorsuch is aboard the Privileges or Immunities Clause train too. Moreover, the rest of the court did not refuse to join the train. They simply ignored the issue. So while in McDonald, eight justices gave reasons for refusing to switch clauses, basically the difficulty of saying exactly what the Privileges or Immunities Clause does mean, even if we know that Slaughterhouse from 1873 and Cruikshank from 1876 are wrong, in Timms, they didn't bother rebutting Thomas or Gorsuch. So we've gone from 8-1 against to 2-0 in favor. The intellectual battle over whether the Privileges or Immunities Clause is the proper vehicle has been won. All that's left is getting the rest of the court to care about the result. Gorsuch noted in his concurrence, "As an original matter, I acknowledge the appropriate vehicle for incorporation may well be the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause, rather than, as this court has long assumed, the Due Process Clause." In addition to citing leading scholars of incorporation like Michael Kent Curtis, Brian Wilmenthal, and Akhil Amar, Justice Gorsuch characterized Justice Thomas's concurrence in McDonald as showing that the Privileges or Immunities Clause covers, at minimum, the individual rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights. Two questions. First, does the restriction to individual rights suggest that provisions originally written as protections for federalism, like the Establishment Clause, might not be incorporated? The issue could get addressed in American Legion v. American Humanists, an incorporated Establishment Clause challenge to a World War I cross memorial that the court heard the week after it decided Timms. None of the lawyers or justices mentioned the 14th Amendment at the American Legion argument, however. Second, what about the at minimum? Does the Privileges or Immunities Clause cover any unenumerated rights outside incorporation? Does it cover, for instance, the sort of rights set out in Meyer v. Nebraska in 1923? the right of the individual to contract, to engage in any of the common occupations of life, to acquire useful knowledge, to marry, establish a home and bring up children, to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience, and generally to enjoy those privileges long recognized at common law as essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. And if unenumerated rights are covered, what criterion would Justice Gorsuch use to find them? Reconstruction history? Consensus today? Moral reality? Or some other criterion? Given Gorsuch's use of tradition in several other cases, and the court's use in Timms itself, one feels sure that some form of tradition will be the key, but the precise form remains to be seen. On the issue of whether the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects unenumerated rights, Justice Thomas's concurrence is, like his concurrence in McDonald, deliciously ambiguous. In McDonald, he relied repeatedly on the work of Kurt Lash, the leading academic defender of an enumerated rights-only approach, but didn't quite endorse his view. In Timms, he doesn't rely directly on Lash, but Justice Thomas does note the Democratic embrace of the same position in opposition to the Civil Rights Act of 1875. Senator Alan Thurman of Ohio was the pioneer of this position in February 1872, and Justice Thomas cites two other Democrats from 1874, Representative Roger Mills and Senator Thomas Norwood. Several other Democrats, Representatives James Beck, Eppa Hunton, and Milton Southard, likewise took the position to oppose the Civil Rights Act of 1875, but no Republicans did. As I see it, the fact that the enumerated rights-only approach was devised by Democratic opponents of Reconstruction is its fatal flaw. Rights in the Civil Rights Acts of 1866 and 1875, like the right to contract, the right to testify, or common carrier rights, are constitutionally unenumerated, but lie at the core of what the Privileges or Immunities Clause needs to cover if we are to adhere to Reconstruction history faithfully. Justice Thomas, to be sure, does not say that he agrees with Mills and Norwood, but I hope to see him disavow their views when the next unenumerated rights case comes along. That may be very soon. One of the parties in the new resident liquor license discrimination case argued in January, Tennessee Wine and Spirits Retail Association v. Blair, raised a Privileges or Immunities Clause issue at length. Because the prospective sellers had already become citizens of Tennessee, discrimination against other state citizens was not directly involved. So neither the Privileges and Immunities Clause of Article 4, nor the Dormant Commerce Clause in their traditional forms, were perfect fits. The Privileges or Immunities Clause was not, alas, discussed at the argument. At some point, however, an unenumerated rights case will surely press Justices Gorsuch and Thomas to resolve whether the at-minimum floor in Gorsuch's concurrence is also a ceiling, and whether Thomas really wants to agree with Reconstruction Democrats who oppose the 14th Amendment rather than the Republicans who adopted it. As always, stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.